2 Corinthians 9 and verse 6. Now remember, we concluded with the whole thought, as Paul says to them, that they are to give not out of sorrow, that is, not out of bad feelings or out of necessities, out of a feeling of being extortion. All the things that he mentions here are things that are the stock in trade of the modern promoter of the faith. The very things Paul says he doesn't want them to do are exactly what they're urged to do over the media today. He says, don't give out of bad feelings. Well, how many are using the cudgel to beat people into the idea that they better give something to God or they're going to be down the drain? And he says not to give out of necessity. How many people flash the picture of the little teary-eyed orphan on the screen? Press the idea, if you don't give, this little child is going to starve to death. That's out of necessity, out of the need of the world is too great. If you go by need, the need will break you, you see. It's too much. If you start saying, I ought to give because so many people are in need. You give because the Spirit of Christ in you encourages you to give, not because you've got to meet all the conditions of this world, because you'd never do anything. You know, you'd start to take a mouthful of food and you'd think, well, maybe I better save this for the orphan. You know, your life would be in total chaos if you tried to give on the basis of need, because there's no end to it. And you'd say, well, I'm going to sell this house and live in a tent so I can give money to the poor. You can't function that way. It's too heavy. And he says, of course, not out of pressure, out of covetousness. That is, as extortion, being extorted. The bloodsuckers, the money suckers today just suck the money right out of the people. Make them feel like bums if they don't give. All these things are that Paul says we should not do are things that are practiced regularly in the presentation of the need for giving over the various kinds of media. It says God loves a cheerful giver. Some have made a point that this word hilaron is the basis of our word hilarious, and that's true, but in a sense, that's where we got our word hilarious, but it is not a fair statement to say God loves a hilarious giver. I've heard that from many quarters. Pseudo-Greek scholars or pseudo-Greek pundits trying to make a case out of that. And he's not saying you should kick up your heels with joyfulness and ecstasy because you can give something. But it does convey the idea of a free and willing and liberal giver. Now, I'm just sort of picking up the loose ends of our discussion last week. But going back to verse 6, he says, but consider this is a good way to read that. But consider this. He who sows sparingly shall reap sparingly. He who sows on the basis of blessing shall reap on the basis of blessing. Now, I read it that way. That's the way it is in the Greek. But if you read it, he that soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly. He that soweth bountifully shall reap bountifully. Puts it on a mercenary basis. If you give bountifully, you'll get it back. That's giving on the basis that, you know, you can't outgive God. How often have you heard that? You can't outgive God. Give and give and give, and he'll always put it back for you. And most of the time, they say he's going to multiply it 100-fold. And, of course, great emphasis is put on that. And here come all the string of testimonies. You know, I started giving to the Lord, and he doubled my business and tripled it and quadrupled it. You could present that to certain segments of our world, and they would just love that kind of odds, you know. It puts it on such a mercenary basis. I know a considerable number of people who give bountifully and struggle with their finances, even though they give. They ask about it, you know, why should it be so when the Bible says, well, the Bible doesn't really say that if you give to the Lord, he'll double your income or anything like that. You give because the Spirit in you wants to give, and what comes back to you is up to God. But all of this comes through on a mercantile basis, just like the presentation of Christ, as we were saying over at the Institute tonight. You've got two leverages here. On the one hand, the claim of Christ is presented on the basis of reward, the goodies. Come to Christ and he'll solve your problems. He'll give you health, wealth, so forth. And so you've got that side of it. And on the other side, you have the penalty, the judgment side. If you don't come to Christ, you're going to get booted. You know, you're going to be in big trouble. You better come to Christ. But I don't often hear the central thrust, which is to say who and what Christ is, because if he is not great enough, if Christ's own person is not enough to cause one to come to him, then the idea of penalties and rewards, or let me put it differently, if Christ is so wonderful and so great, then the leverage on the basis of penalty and reward is unworthy of him. I understand the passage of judgment. On the other hand, primarily the judgment passages are leveled at people like the Pharisees, for example, who were the religious leaders, or world rulers. Not the common man, not the average John Q. public. Because that kind of a thing is, for example, would be the analogy of that would be like the bride who is presented to the groom either on the basis of the shotgun or on the basis of a bribe. If you marry my daughter, I'll give you a decent dowry. So he pawns off his daughter on someone by promising him a share in the business or something. That's the reward side of it. Or he says, if you don't marry my daughter, I'll pay you for a buckshot. Well, this is the way Christ is presented. If you don't come to Christ, you get it for a buckshot, you know. Or the reason you're supposed to come to Christ is because you're going to get a dowry, or you're going to get extra benefits. And I've said before, the good analogy to this is the commercial on television, which presents certain sewing machine that is the most marvelous unit ever manufactured, and we're selling it to you for half price. Now, if you'll buy tonight, we'll also give you a button holder. You know, and I'm saying, if it's such a great deal, why do we have to throw in the button holder? If Christ is so great, if what he is not enough to draw us, then rewards and punishments thrown in are unworthy, you see. All of this on the basis that if we give simply for the reward that we're going to get out of it, or we give because we're threatened if we don't give, then nothing is coming from the Spirit, you see. He continues in verse 8. Now, let me go back to this other point about the blessing. He that sows sparingly shall reap sparingly. But he shows the essence of what he's trying to say is not material or mercenary, because he says, he that sows blessings shall reap blessing. And this word for blessing has nothing to do with material things. It has to do with blessing of the Spirit. Now, we don't need to bring the idea of money into this at all, in a way. Not everybody has money to give, but you have yourselves to give. You have grace to give, love, kindness, and so forth. Now, if you are the kind of person who is a blessing to people, you know, wherever you go, you're a blessing to people. The blessing comes back to you, not monetarily, see, not financially or materially, but your heart is lifted. You're going to be satisfied inside. You're going to sleep at night. You're going to be at peace with yourself. But if you're always worried about what's happening to you, to number one, and whether you're getting enough happiness or not, you know, if you're always worried about your full measure, you're going to have trouble, I have to say. All right, well, that's contrary, of course, to the biblical theme. And that's what Paul is expressing here, where he says, he that sows sparingly will reap sparingly, and the life just shrivels up. He that sows in blessing will reap blessing. Not material, necessarily, but spiritual blessing. And there's no greater thing in the world than peace of mind. To feel, to believe that basically you are moving in the right direction. Basically, your concern is for others and you're not worried too much about what happens to you personally. We'll move on in this. Each one of you, even as he has established beforehand or purposed beforehand in his heart, and as we said before, not out of sorrow or out of necessity, but out of liberty and freedom. Now, verse 8, God is able to make all grace abound unto you, in order that in all things you may always have all sufficiency, as you abound unto every good work, even as it is written, so forth. Now, first of all, we leave just the realm of the material. In terms of material things, Christian people who are completely committed to Christ cannot always expect abundance of personal goods, material goods. Jesus never promised anything more than a roof over your head and food for yourself, clothes on your back. Not even the roof, just the clothes on your back and something to eat. He has promised that, but nothing more. And I have said to you before, Satan, who is the god of this world, is not always happy to have the Lord's people prosper. He'll do everything he can to give you a rough life on the earth because he doesn't want to make it good for you. And he's sort of in charge of a lot of things. So you mustn't be surprised if material problems keep cropping up. Satan is good at lousing up the fortunes of the believer. But he's not talking about that. He's talking about an inner sufficiency. You always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound unto every good work. Now, as far as the work is concerned, I've gone over this considerably with you. We're not talking about necessarily deeds per se. We're talking about the working of the Spirit of Christ within us. This is the work of God, that you believe on him who sent you, Jesus' attitude. It is God that works in you to will and to do of his good pleasure. See, God works in us. And that's the kind of work he's talking about, not going out and doing good deeds. The work of Christ in us is enhanced by the openness and graciousness with which we relate to one another. I've spoken to you before about the fact that, in a certain sense, we're all an island. Whereas the psychologist says no man is an island, there's another sense in which we're all islands, because in the last analysis, we have to gut out our own situation. In other words, you lie in bed at night, and you're the one who has to put up with the things that are going through your head. People can hold your hand or pat you on the back or whatever, but you're the one that has to gut it out. Inside. Now, in that sense, we're an island. No matter how much people may try to help us, we have to go through the feelings. Therefore, the important thing is to build a platform of strength inside ourselves. Through Christ, of course. We take that for granted. But everything outside of you is subject to dissolution. You can lose everything. Family, friends, possessions, whatever. All you really have that you can depend on is your own person. Now, when you have the Spirit of Christ in you, of course, you have the substance that you need. But the cultivating of strength within yourself by your identity with Christ and so forth is the best way to survive, where you're not dependent on anything outside of you for that survival. If instead of trying always to draw from others, your attitude is, how can I be an island of strength to give to them? So you build up strength in yourself so you're able to contribute that strength to the people around you. Now, as your whole attitude is giving strength to others, then in a certain sense that comes back to you again in strength to yourself, in building yourself. The more you're able to reach out and give to others, the more you strengthen that inner platform. So don't think in terms of how can they give to me, or what can I give to them in the way of help and blessing and strength. The psychologists make a big issue out of the fact that people need a listening ear and we ought to be a friend to everyone and to listen to their problems. So there is a sense in which you can go beyond your strength if you make yourself available to everyone. So you have to watch that. On the other hand, there are people that always come with their own problems. You have a neighbor, for example, that's going to come for a coffee every day, and the neighbor is just a bundle of problems. Well, there's only so much of that you can stand. Or you've got a friend who, you've said to that person, now, you know, I'm here, and here's your telephone, you know, you call. So they start doing that. Pretty soon you get tired of the fact that every time they call, there's trouble. They never stop to think, how can I bless you, and how can you help me? See, well, that, a little of that goes a long way. You have to watch this. You've got your blessing, your giving of yourself to others has got to be in the spirit. And you've got to learn when to say no and where to draw the line. If the Lord has given you a task to do, He'll give you the strength to do it. If you are ministering to some people, I'm not talking now about official ministry, I'm talking about just giving to some of help and blessing and encouragement and so forth. If you're ministering to some people and it's flowing all right and you're at peace about everything, then that's fine. But the moment it starts to become too big a burden to you, then you're going beyond your strength and you got to back off. You can get crushed yourself in that. When I say to you, you must learn to be a blessing to others and not to think about yourself. On the other hand, you have to watch it that you're doing it in the spirit, not in the flesh. Instead of looking out for people that you can take under your wing, you better just say, well, now, Lord, you bring to me the people you want to have me help when you're ready for it. You see, you have to measure that out. There are some people that, that I know that just have literally destroyed themselves trying to be too much to too many people. Whereas I'm saying to you, be liberal in giving of yourself, yet I'm saying to you, recognize your limitations. On the one hand, be careful not to go beyond your strength, because that is not going to be a blessing to them. On the other hand, don't become a burden to somebody by being too much of a weight on them. All right, well, the Lord will have to give you grace in those and understanding in those matters and direct you in His Spirit. It says, even as it is written, this is from the Psalms, a quotation, He has scattered abroad, He has given to the poor, His righteousness endures forever. And it just goes along with the same idea of open and generous to people to help them. Verse 10, He who supplies seed to the sower and bread to the eater shall supply and multiply your seed and cause to grow the fruit of your righteousness. Again, I come back to the point, the Lord will give you the strength to do what He has asked you to do, but He will not give you the strength to do more than that. The moment you begin to feel that you're going beyond your strength in reaching out to people, just watch it, because otherwise you'll burn yourself out and you won't be any good to anybody. As long as the load is comfortable and you can handle it, you're all right. But as soon as it begins to be too much of a burden, then you better ask the Lord, you know, whether maybe you've stepped beyond your capacity in these matters. You may be in over your head. He will supply to you what you need to give what He wants you to give. God will supply to you what you need to give what He wants you to give. He will multiply or cause to grow the fruit of your righteousness. Now we can take a parallel in Galatians 5:22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. But I've often said that that fruit begins on the tree as a hard little green thing that's pretty bitter. And you may have the fruit all right, but it needs cultivating, needs to develop and mature. God is Himself able to make that fruit of yours grow or mature. I think that's a better word to use here. He'll make your fruit mature. You'll become more and more a blessing to people around you as the Spirit in you causes the fruit of your righteousness to mature. It will mature as you identify with Christ each day, as you can become a worker for Christ and remain sour all your life. You'd be a sour apple and still be a great worker for Jesus. Many a person who has been a very energetic worker for God, when they get with their families, they're sour apples. Family can't stand them. But they're out, you know, telling everybody else how to raise their family. Well, okay. Everything being enriched unto all single-mindedness. The same word Jesus uses in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, you've got to be single-minded. The eye that is single is full of light. Simple-minded. We gave you the illustration we have several times of the laser beam, which is coordinated light rather than diffused light. And without going into that technology tonight, I just want to say that as long as your mind is totally single of purpose, your life will be full of light. If what you want to do in your life is what Christ wants in your life, then there'll be great power. But now if you're thinking, for example, in terms of your own self-advancement, my career, my interests, and so forth, I mean to say in material ways, you're not single-minded. If you say, Lord, what do you want about this job? What job do you want me to take? What house should I live in? Where should I go? You know, what should I do? If your whole concern is what does Christ want, that means your heart is single and simple. If you're saying I want my pleasure, I want my advancement and so forth, your mind isn't single. Your mind is then saying you've got a constant contest between what you want and what Christ wants. But if all you want is what Christ wants in your life, there's great power there and there's great enrichment. So we should read this verse 11. In everything being enriched unto single-mindedness. There is a sense in which the enrichment of God makes us poor as far as this world is concerned, but rich as far as faith is concerned. We become poor in the flesh that we may be rich in the spirit. We see our flesh as demanding things that militate against the pure and simple moving of the Spirit within our lives. It's not a matter of self-denial. That can be very religious. The Hindu is probably the very quintessence of self-denial. Hindu who sits in a bizarre position on the steps of the temple and just starves himself to death to prove how holy he is. This is a religious fanaticism, and it's of the flesh. It's a religious flesh. But the person who says, Christ, whatever you want on my life, that's what I want, you see. That will impoverish you in the flesh because there are things that you will not feel comfortable in doing. There are projects you'll have to turn down in order to do what Christ wants. One has often had to turn down many, many thousands of dollars of advantage for Christ's sake. Many opportunities that one has had to set aside for Christ's sake. For example, as I've said it before, but I'll just give it again, that an ex-governor of this state urged me to run for the Senate at one time. We were good friends. We had lunch together quite a bit, and he wanted me to run for the Senate. He wanted to back me, wanted me to come to his home, meet his family, wanted to put me into that position. And he said, you'll have a good platform for your ministry if you do that, you see. And I turned it down. Why? Because it wasn't compatible with what Christ wanted. I could have rationalized it and said, well, that's right, I'd have a great platform now. I could be well known and I could use that notoriety or that renown to speak about Christ and so forth. I could have rationalized it, but it wasn't what Christ wanted. It's personal. These things are very, very personal. But I'm just saying to you that we turn down things that are not what Christ wants, even though we can rationalize them. You sometimes jump off the cliff in a way because you have to launch out to do something the Lord wants. But you see, the only way you're going to be at peace in yourself is to do at each point what Christ wants. But the moment your own flesh gets in the way, the moment you say, well, this isn't a very good thing, but I want to do it anyway. You know deep in your heart you're on the wrong track, but you're rationalizing it, you see. And you're taking a chance on something. Sometimes people out there just gambling away their whole peace of mind in the hope that the Lord will let them get away with it. See? The things people know they shouldn't be involved in, or they know they shouldn't take this course deep inside, but they're going to roll on the hope, the dice, they're rolling the old bones there in the hope they'll get away with it. And you have to ask yourself now, what are you doing that you hope you'll get away with? Because you like it so much, you'd rather not set it aside, even though you know Christ would just as soon, would rather you'd set that aside, and you're not doing it because you're hoping against hope he'll let you get away with it. We've got here that you are enriched unto simplicity. There's nothing richer in the world than simplicity. In fact, even in design, the more extravagant, that is, the more you pay for the gown, the simpler it is, probably. You pay for the restraint, is what I'm saying. The same thing is true in something we've been involved in considerably, landscaping, for example. Really high-quality landscape is restrained. The Japanese were just past masters at this, at landscaping. A rock, some gravel, a plant or two, may make an entire landscape. But what a graceful and peaceful thing it is. And you go to some landscapes that are just busy, so busy, too much in it. You pay for the restraint. A rock, a tree, a patch of blooming gazanias or something, and it's a beautiful landscape. But you can stick a lot of plants around and look terrible. The amateur does that. The amateur landscaper or amateur gardener just throws too much in there, you see. You pay for the restraint. How elegant simplicity is in anything. I'm trying to illustrate what Paul is really getting across here. You are enriched in simplicity. How rich the life that has Christ as the central feature. And you're not torn off in a dozen directions by things that are self-aggrandizing, self-elevating, but do not elevate Christ. And that kind of life gets tiresome. Again, like a painting, if the colors are too bright, and it's too busy, you get tired looking at it. If it's too busy, you get tired of it. How elegant and rich is simplicity. And he says, through which he has wrought out through us thanksgiving to God. The single-minded person is constantly sensitive to what God has given. We take things from God. That is to say, instead of looking at life as a series of coincidences or achieving on our own merits, we're always grateful to God for everything he gives us, every friend, every blessing. We're grateful to God for it. And this kind of simplicity of life promotes gratitude to God. I'm so thankful when I pass through village communities, the suburban communities, for example, and I see the wealth there, and I see people, and I get involved with people that have wealth. I constantly thank God for delivering me from that. You drive through some of these very exclusive suburbs, hear these homes, you think to yourself how much complexity there is in those lives to maintain this situation. A person that buys a home out of their echelon, I'm not going to say class because that might sound just a little bit crass, but you buy a home that is a very remarkable deal and you get it in a neighborhood that's just a little bit above your style. Now what have you got? Whole series of complexities, because now it's what the children have to put up with at school, what they have to wear to keep up with the neighborhood children. And you can't mow your own lawn because that's not done in that neighborhood. You have to have a gardener, you see. And one thing, this is an illustration, not too many of you are troubled with this, but it's just a good analogy. It's a good recommendation in looking for a home, for example. People shouldn't get into a place that is out of their normal echelon because it multiplies the problems. Now, that's only a simple illustration of the fact that we multiply our problems by going for anything that is in the flesh because the flesh is never satisfied and one thing always leads to another. Just like the automobile, just another simple illustration here. Unfortunately, the poor people are the ones that have the least opportunity to save and to live frugally. Because you see, if you're too poor to buy a new car, you have to buy a used one. And if you buy a used one, you're buying lots of trouble. And of course, the poorer you are, the more luxurious the automobile you can afford. Because you can buy a loaded luxury Chrysler for much less than you can buy an economy model of some moderate vehicle, you see. But the poor people get saddled with all these old gas hogs. They were once a luxury symbol. Now the older the car gets, the more it's a symbol of poverty. But people cannot afford to buy the economy model, so they buy the luxury model. And that complicates everything because the repairs get complex and the mileage is low. And it's so many things that complicate it. But it's only a ludicrous illustration of the nature, the diminishing returns in the world of the flesh, the natural life, because so much around us complicates our lives and closes off the abundant flow of the interaction with Christ. Now, God is not going to throw you into hell for this. I'm not saying to any of you here tonight that if you don't get busy now and start pruning out your life and getting rid of the flesh, that you're going to in trouble. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just trying to give you some very sage advice about the meaning of simplicity and about the need in your life of going more and more toward the centrality of Christ and less toward the complicated aspects of a fleshly life. How elegant is simplicity?